Okay. I've got a mic in my mouth. Welcome. This is Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. And to my right is Bernice Kandarian, president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. I'm still right here, okay. Bernice. It'll be down my throat if I get any closer. We wish to welcome you to this morning's workshop on advocacy. As you've read, we're going to be looking at housing, health care, and also transportation from the Air Carriers Access Act. We're very fortunate this morning to have speakers that are very knowledgeable on the various areas, and this is an outcome of issues that have arisen within the last few months that our members have brought to our attention and wanted to know more about some of their rights so that they could better advocate. I've got a few more comments, but I'm going to ask Bernice if she has any comments she'd like to say about this morning or with the remaining agenda of the Council of Citizens with Low Vision. And I'm handing the mic over to Bernice.
Okay. Good morning, and welcome especially to those low vision members that have joined us this morning. We will have one more session on Saturday morning, and we have a speaker from AT&T come and ask all of your telephone questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernice. So just before we start, I wish to let you know that right now of an activity that the American Council of Blind and its Environmental Access Committee are currently working on, and that is developing a response to proposed public right-of-way act guidelines. Now, for the last 10 years, the U.S. Access Board has generated proposed access guidelines for what things should be in a public right-of-way. This is like curb ramps, street furniture, detectable warnings, accessible pedestrian signals, anything that you should find along the public sidewalk. They're covering most of these areas, including roundabouts. We are right now, the Environmental Access Committee, are in the process of drafting comments for the ACB, and there is a deadline of November 23rd for comments. I would like to suggest that those of you who are interested in the subject, that you go to the U.S. Access Board's website, which is access-board.gov, and looked at this, and you stroll down to where you find proposed regulations, guidelines, and in there you will find the guidelines that were issued on July 23rd, 2011, and closing date is November 23rd, 2011. There's many ways of providing input, but probably the easiest way would be to email, and this is the email address, is row@access-board.gov. Then you'd put docket number ATBCB2011-04. It's a lengthy document, at least 93 pages. However, if you have strong feelings about things in the public right-of-way, if you wrote a letter giving your opinion, they would try to fit these things in. I will talk about this afternoon during the CATS business session, which To be honest with you, you'd have to check the program. I need to find the location, but that will be after our general session. There are several critical things we need to comment that will be that will receive a lot of opposition. One, there's some excellent language in for accessible pedestrian signals. One of the things that they are pushing for, despite all the opposition they've received, and that is that when new signals, when new traffic signals are installed, that they automatically be equipped with APSs, or when they're being upgraded, going to alterations like new software, the traffic controllers being modified or so forth, they also would be equipped with APSs. And these APSs would be the digital type that we've seen Polara Engineering, there's the Campbell product, and Novak's Canadian product has somewhat a similar product. But Campbell and Novak's are the ones that actually meet the letter of what the Federal Highway Administration has in its manual on uniform traffic control devices. And there's issues on detectable warnings and other things. So we could talk further about that, but I want to let you know that this is something, have an opportune time, because it's what the federal government is doing is it's a lot of counting. It's almost like votes where the last time around on APSs, it was a, there was 1-2 where for every one of comments from the opposition on APSs, there were at least two in favor. And that was also for detectable warnings. We really want to maintain that. We could lose all these things. So, anyway, let you know about that. Now, this morning, there's been some changes in some of our the speakers, but we still have the topics. And we do have our first is our a workshop on housing rights. It's going to be interactive workshop. Our speaker will tell how she'd like to conduct it. Let's follow her directions, and this will be covering those, I'm understanding, on some of your protections as a person with a disability, but also those of you just who, regardless of disability, some of the statewide ordinances and protections you have from, especially if you rent. So I'm going to ask our first speaker to introduce herself. That's been a change, and please give her a hand.
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. My name is Shri Panchalam. I'm an attorney at Disability Rights Legal Center, which is a nonprofit organization located in downtown Los Angeles. We're a cross-disability organization. Basically, the number of things that we do is we do a number of impact suits, meaning that we address issues in the court that affect a large number of people with disabilities. And so those are primarily the cases that we bring. A lot of our cases are in federal court. We also have a special education program addressing the needs of students in with school districts regarding their special education needs. And we also have newly revamped our community advocacy program. And so if you come to our intake line, they're able to provide you resources and in certain situations write you letters. For example, if you need a reasonable accommodation letter, if it's something we can do, we're more than happy to do that. And I'll give you that number toward the end of the presentation. My presentation today is primarily on tenants' rights. And so, and my experience is mostly with the intersection between disability and housing. And so what I'd like to offer you is what comes across my table every day, which is first and foremost, what are your rights in housing in terms of requesting reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications to enable you equal access to housing? And how do you do that? And so I'm going to go over the concepts first, And then I'd like you to, and I'm going to give some examples, and hopefully we can all walk through them, of imaginary folks, or if anybody wants to volunteer their own examples, we can walk through those, whatever you feel comfortable doing, by way of having something we can actually apply what I'm talking about to. So hopefully by the end of this, everyone here will know all the things they need to say when they need to request a reasonable accommodation, reasonable modification, what your rights are with a landlord, for example, if they say no, or we can't do that. And so I'll get started. And so there's a number of federal laws and state laws that create an affirmative obligation, meaning that they say you have to provide people reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications. Most federal laws definitely say that it is the landlord that has to make a reasonable accommodation. And I'll go over what that is and what the difference is between a reasonable accommodation and what a reasonable modification is. And those laws are the Federal Fair Housing Act, the California Fair Employment and Housing Act, Title II of the ADA, where the housing is run by a public entity. So if the housing authority of the city of Los Angeles or the housing authority in your area operates housing, the Title II may apply. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, if the housing that you're in or the entity that operates housing receives federal financial assistance, they get some kind of benefit or funds from the federal government within the meaning of that act. Section 504 says that those entities have to provide a reasonable accommodation. And Title III, which covers public accommodations, any private entity open to the public, but also areas of your housing that the public is invited to, such as the manager's office, or if you have a mixed-use building, for example, and they have a restaurant downstairs or a cafe or something, all of those areas come under Title III because they're private entities open to the public, even though there are maybe tenants' units or housing in the rest of the area. And in general, well, at least the Federal Fair Housing Act and the California Fair Employment and Housing Act only say that they permit reasonable accommodations. So if you're at reasonable modifications, meaning if you're asking for a physical change in the premises and not a waiver of a policy, practice, or procedure that the landlord or the housing operator has, the Federal Fair Housing Act says that they only have to permit you to do that. The Federal Fair Housing Act covers most housing situations. So if you're currently renting, you except for owner occupied or single family dwellings. And what that means basically is that if it's housing covered by Section 504, Title II of the ADA, meaning it's operated, has received federal financial assistance, or is operated by a public entity, the housing operator has much higher obligations in, more often than not, they have to make the reasonable modifications themselves. They have to make the physical changes themselves. But if you're in housing covered by the Federal Fair Housing Act and the California Fair Employment and Housing Act, they only have to let you do that. So if you would like race type, for example, outside your unit to make it more identifiable, they would have to permit you to do that. But if it's in the common areas, it's more likely that the landlord is going to have to make those physical changes. So if it's to the elevators, if it's to things in the lobby to make them more accessible to someone who is blind or who has low vision, it's more likely that the landlord is going to have to make that anyway. So reasonable accommodations, as I touched on, are basically a change in a rule, a policy, practice, or service that may be necessary to allow a person with a disability the equal opportunity to use and enjoy a dwelling. And you may be familiar with some of these already. Common examples include waiver of a no pet policy to permit a service animal, or provision of an assigned accessible parking space, or adjustment of a rent due date where income is connected to disability. For example, if you receive Social Security disability income and that's how you're paying your rent, but it does come on the 1st as the landlord wants to be paid, but it comes on the 5th. That's an accommodation request you can make. And these are just some examples. The laws, just so you know, don't enumerate accommodations, meaning they don't have a list of accommodations that are set in stone. Accommodations are about this person in this situation. What does this person need to have equal access to housing? And reasonable accommodation, as I touched on before, is a physical change to a dwelling or a common area. So common examples include ramps, flashing doorbells, lower counters, wider doorways, grab bars, a raised type on the elevator buttons. Anything that you have to actually change some kind of physical structure or add on something to a physical structure, that would fall under accommodations. Modifications. But really, you really have to just know this. Are you looking for a change in the policy, practice, service, or procedure? Are you asking the housing operator to change a rule of theirs, like a no pet policy? Or are you asking them to add something physical?
Could we hold off the conversations going on in the rear of the room, please?
And so there are some requirements for what a reasonable accommodation has to look like in terms of, I said, there's no list of reasonable accommodations, but it still has to meet certain requirements. Both reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications, the changes in policies, practices, and procedures, or the physical changes, have to be both necessary and reasonable, meaning that there has to be a nexus means that there's a connection between the disability, the requested change, and the ability to use or enjoy the housing.
I apologize. If somebody in the rear wouldn't mind shutting the door, and I apologize, I thought it was somebody carrying on a conversation in the back of the room. Apparently that noise from the hallway is drifting in. Thank you.
So the first part is that a accommodation or a modification has to be necessary, meaning it has to be required for equal use and enjoyment of the housing for a person with a disability. And common examples include, it frees the tenant from a rule or policy or practice that interferes with the person's right to use or enjoy the dwelling. So, for example, with a service animal, if a service animal is necessary for someone to be able to effectively navigate their housing situation, an accommodation you could request is that if the landlord has in place the no pet policy, the accommodation you're requesting is a waiver of that policy so that you may have the service animal, because it enables a person who is blind or with low vision to be able to access their housing in the same way as a person who is not blind or does not have low vision. Or it improves tenant access to a unit by removing architectural barriers. So, for example, if there's no braille plate outside of the elevator, and that impedes someone's access to getting on the elevator, or outside of each tenant unit there isn't type outside the door so that people can identify where they are and where they're going. That's the physical change that you could ask for, because it improves access to the common areas, your unit, kind of thing. It enhances the tenant's quality of life by ameliorating the effects of the disability, or it enables the tenant to satisfy essential requirements of tenancy, the same as a person without disabilities. And reasonable means primarily two things, or three things. One, it can't create an undue financial or administrative burden. And when we say that, we're considering cost, we're considering benefit to the tenant, financial resources of the provider, and availability of an equally effective or less expensive alternative. Know that the laws envision some kind of cost or financial burden on the provider. The key is that it can't be undue, meaning it can't consume an incredible amount of financial resources, an incredible amount of administrative resources if it requires a lot of bodies, et cetera, to be able to enable their accommodation. But finances and administrative burden is seen not only in light of, for example, the landlord of the building that you're living in currently, but say it's connected, for example, to a larger entity. There's a bigger property management company, or the housing authority operates your housing. It's in light of all of their resources and all of the resources of their subsidiaries and whoever else. So even if they say, hey, this building has no funding, you're not looking at necessarily this building. You're looking at the resources of the entity and pretty much everything that they own, and kind of just determining whether this is an accommodation that can be made. And another thing a housing operator might say is that it is a fundamental alteration, and that would make an accommodation not reasonable, meaning that it can't alter essentially what the provider's operations are. So, for example, if a housing operator is, just to illustrate the difference, if a housing operator is providing transportation, say, to the local grocery store, but that is not accessible to a person with a disability because they're not providing accessible vans, there's no way for a person with a wheelchair otherwise to really understand what's going on. Or the bus driver is really recalcitrant and he's not wanting to assist anybody with anything. What you're looking at in that situation is that since the housing operator is already providing the bus to the grocery store, that has to be accessible to persons with disabilities. But if, for example, the housing provider never provided a bus and now somebody would like transportation to the grocery store, it's not necessary that the housing provider has to provide a bus to do that, because what the housing provider is doing is providing housing for the most part, and that would change sort of the essential business of what the housing provider does. But if they're somehow providing services, resources, etc., outings, things like that in connection with the housing, they're already organizing those things, that should be accessible to everyone in the building. So with physical changes, and this happens sometimes, the housing provider does have the right, if you ask for physical changes to your unit in some way, the housing provider can condition permission on a reasonable description of the proposed modification, meaning that they can ask for what are you going to do and how are you going to do it. They can require the work to be done in a workmanlike manner so that they can ensure that there's no damage to the premises. Like, they can require that somebody who's doing the work be licensed and have all the permits necessary in order to do the work if that's what's required of the situation. And in very limited circumstances, they can require what's called a restoration agreement, meaning that when you leave a unit, you put back the unit in the way it was before. So you undo the physical change. But I say that's in a really narrow set of circumstances, because it's only in the situation where the physical change would interfere with the tenant's use, the next tenant's use and enjoyment of the premises. This actually frequently comes up in the situation of grab bars in a shower, where that's something that a tenant or a landlord might actually be able to require you to remove once you leave. But say it's something like wider doorways. That's not necessarily going to affect the next person's use of the premises. It's just a wider door and they can get in it the same way as anybody else can. So the important thing to remember is that accommodations and modifications, whether it's necessary or reasonable, is determined on a case-by-case basis. It's an individual assessment. It is about this person and this situation. What a housing provider can't do is say, well, I don't want to look at this accommodation request. I don't want to grant this accommodation because, you know, other people in the building who have similar disabilities or other people in the building with disabilities or just other people are just going to ask me for things and I'm going to have to do the same thing. So just because it opens the doors to other requests doesn't mean that they can deny this one. And each request that you ask for is considered separately without regard to the request you made in the past or requests you made in the future. This is about now and what you're asking for now. And of course, does anyone have an idea of what happens? So what if you make an accommodation request and a landlord says no? What would your next steps be? Like, what could you say to the landlord? Why? And really, what you could say why? Because the landlord has an obligation to engage in the interactive process with you, meaning that they have to have a dialogue about why they can't provide you a particular accommodation. And if they can't provide you a particular accommodation, then they do have to provide you a comparable alternative that will enable you equal access to housing. Let's say you've met all of these requirements. You know, it is necessary for you to have equal access to housing. It is a reasonable accommodation. Sometimes a landlord might say, you know, I don't know that this is reasonable for some of the things that I said before. But that doesn't mean they can just walk away from it. And they can't just, if they don't like it, they can't just ignore your request and they can't just say no. They have to have a conversation with you about what it is they need and how it is they can assist you in enabling you to have equal access to your housing. And so when you're making an accommodation request, and this is when we're going to work through some examples, so there are sort of three things that you want to say. You, number one, want to say that you have a disability. Do you have to fork over your medical records? I want someone to tell me. Do you have to fork over medical records to the landlord? No. That is right. You don't have to do that. You have to say you have a disability. You have to describe the accommodation that you want. And you have to explain how the accommodation would help you. Sometimes some information about your disability may be helpful. And you don't have to, if the landlord's like, well, I need verification. Sometimes verification, I'll be honest, can help. Like if you have a doctor's note or something like that, that can be very helpful. However, they're not supposed to be giving you a burdensome document request saying, well, I need you to do all of these things before you prove to me that you have a disability, especially if your disability is obvious to them in some way. And they've known about it for a while, or for example, if you're in a wheelchair, you have a wheelchair, or if you have a cane, or if you've had a service animal for a long time, and you have sort of these obvious signs of your disability, they can't suddenly be like, well, I don't know that you have one, and I need you to give me all of the stuff to prove that you do. That's not correct. And timing. There is no bad time to make a reasonable accommodation request. You can make a request at any time. And the housing provider, again, can request the verification of that a tenant meets the Act's definition of disability. And definitely when, but again, I'm sorry, I think there's a question. Sure.
I guess my next step would be to do my request in writing. Is there a requirement that they respond to my written request in a certain period of time?
You know, as a rule of thumb, you can specify that in a written request. And to the extent that it's possible, I would always make written requests. The law doesn't require that you have to make written requests, because sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we don't have a pen and paper. We don't have a computer to be like, I'm going to type this out and print it out and send it to you. But, it's good generally to specify, you know, these are all of the steps. I have a disability. I want this accommodation. This is why I want the accommodation. This is how it's going to help me. And I want you to respond to me within a certain period of time. That is fair. And I'll talk about some of the different places that you can send a complaint to. Also, if the landlord really is just not working with you, if they really just don't respond or whatever it is. So just what the housing provider can request. They can request verification that it meets the Act's definition. They can request information if they don't understand the accommodation, they can request further information on that. They can request information that this is connected to your disability. So some information may help in terms of how it's going to help you and why this is necessary really in this situation. Let's see. But for example, just to go back to information about the needed accommodation, if they don't understand what your accommodation is, that's not grounds for them to say, okay, I'm just not going to follow up on this. I don't know what you want. Their obligation in that situation, again, is to talk to you, is to say, I don't understand what you're asking for. Can you explain that to me? That's what they're supposed to be doing. They're not just supposed to say, well, I don't get this, so I'm not going to do it, or I'm just going to ignore it, and that's going to be my excuse. And so I think this is a good time to walk through an example. So I want, and we're going to just do different pieces of this and people can chime in. So I'm going to give you a situation. Bob lives in a building. He rents a unit in a building, and he is blind and he has a service animal. The landlord has a no pet policy, and he sees Bob when he walks into the rental office with his service animal and says, Bob, I'm sorry, do you plan on bringing your dog to live here? Because we don't allow pets here. Now, this is the application process. I'm going to ask you, can Bob put in a reasonable accommodation request at the outset during the application process? Can he make an accommodation request then? I mean, he can't. I mean, here's the thing. If they says, well, we have a no pet policy, and he sees Bob with a dog. So this is I'm going to make this tricky. This is a private building. This is a private building, and the ADA doesn't cover this building. So this is a private landlord, and the Federal Fair Housing Act covers this building. And he doesn't understand why Bob needs this. But we're sitting in the rental office, and Bob says, you know, I meet all the income requirements. Everything else is fine. I can do everything else, but he's saying, I can't bring my dog. Can Bob, even in that conversation, make a request? And a reasonable accommodation is, can he make a request in the application? He's not a tenant there. Yeah. Saying, I'd like to be able to bring my dog. Yes, he can do that. Just as I mentioned before, you can make a request at any time. But say, for example, that rental application wasn't accessible to you, that you couldn't, they just handed it to you and said, here. But you need that rental application in large type, for example, or you need it in a format. Maybe you need it on a CD so you can go home and you have a program that can read it to you so you can actually understand the terms and the agreement. That is something you can request at the outset. That's an accommodation related directly to the application process. There's a question in the back? Mm-hmm.
There's no mic. Are we okay to
Yeah, I can hear. I mean, again, it's like it's different for. I'd say it's different for folks in different situations. Is the person? It depends. Are you comfortable with that? Are you comfortable with that? Is there a special reason that you would want somebody to? Because if they're like, he's like, oh, I don't know how to do this, or I don't know exactly what you need. So. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, say the housing provider, you go in to fill a rental application, and he says, well, I can't give it to you in an accessible format, but I'm going to read it to you and fill it in for you. And, I mean, if the person feels that that's appropriate in that situation, that may be permissible. But there may be special reasons for why you don't want the landlord filling out your rental application. You want somebody to, you want to be able to fill it out yourself, or if you're going to get assistance, you want someone else to help you. And you may say, you know what, that's not going to work for me. And help the housing provider understand why. Because as a person with a disability, that person understands best what they need. And the housing provider has the resources to sort of meet what they need. So if that's not gonna work, you can explain that. Any other questions? I think there's a question in the corner. Question. I'm gonna take one on the right first. Sorry, my right, so your left. So on the door side of the room. Thank you. Uh-huh.
Okay. Just a little more clarification on that. Pre-ADA days, I would let a landlord help me fill out the application.
I mean, I think the basic question, let me know if I get it wrong, is that are there any reasons why you would not want the landlord to fill out a housing application?
Yeah.
For the very reason that it's a personal decision, and it depends on how you feel about the situation too. But maybe it's a situation that they're really just the other party on the other side of the contract, and you don't want them filling out the application because of that. You know, just as a practical point. Yeah, it's sort of a business transaction, and this is the person you're contracting with, and you don't necessarily know what's going to happen in the future in this situation. And it's sort of a personal decision as to whether, you know, do you want to trust this housing provider, or would you rather have it filled out by someone like a family member or somebody else who you'd like to, or a friend that you trust, that would you like to take that back home? And if that's what you would like to do, would that be better? It's just like, you never know, because in the future circumstances may change. And so, but that's something too. Mm-hmm. There was a question, I think, on the wall side of the room, the wall without the door side. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
tenants have the right to do that, and do we have the right to say you can't have the eviction there?
At the community center where you live currently? The polling place is there. And I don't know that these laws wouldn't cover the community center. It may be if... Oh, it's the tenants. Oh, okay. So these are your rights if you are a tenant currently, like if you're a tenant in housing, if you're a tenant, if you're a potential tenant seeking housing. And I think your situation addresses problems with tenants that are currently in another building, which is a little different. So if we were talking about you as an individual in a housing situation, then these rights would affect you. That I'm not sure. I'd have to know more about the situation to really understand what's going on. There's a question near the door toward the front. Yes.
Okay. I've had this happen several times when renting a place and the landlord is reading me the lease and asking me to sign various places on the lease.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to sign here. It's really, really long, but what it basically says is dot, dot, dot.
Okay.
I'm just signing it because I don't want to spend 100 years dealing with it. Am I then bound by all the stipulations in that section because I signed it?
Sure. Yes, because you signed the lease.
Right.
And it would, I mean, just as a practical point again, if you're uncomfortable, you don't know this landlord, for example. It's like if a stranger was reading you a lease and saying, I want you to sign right here, or you know what, this is just too long. You should sign this. Maybe not the best thing to do. And find somebody more trustworthy to read that to you. Yes, and toward the back wall. Well, the Federal Fair Housing Act still covers those situations, and so you would be able to put in a request for a modification or a physical change to the premises, so they would put Braille on the elevators.
When the California Building Code, which requires to require those signs to be in common use areas?
You know, I mean, to tell you the truth, and lawyers do this all the time, we have to go look up the books just to make sure, because there are so many different housing codes. There's the California Building Code. If the ADA covers it, it's the ADAG. If Section 504 covers it, there's the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standard. So depending on it depends on what kind of funding the building is getting, which one of the guidelines apply in that situation, it can get really complicated. So fortunately, I can't give you a straight answer right now, but pretty much all of these laws, as I discussed before, do allow you to request that change happen. It may be also that depending on what the date of the housing is and that kind of thing, that can also affect what their obligations are and what standards apply. Whether it's like existing, whether it's an existing building, whether it's new construction. All of that varies too.
Are there any other questions people might have?
And so, just to let's, I think What time is it?
We got a few more minutes.
We got a few more minutes. Okay. So just to go along with Bob, right? So Bob has a service animal, and so Bob gets a unit in this building. Landlord still has the no pet policy in place, but Bob's landlord decides at some point, you know what? He's going to reinforce this no pet policy. He's going to say, he's like, yeah, I said it was okay then, but you know what? It's really causing a problem, because he's like, I don't know. The dog has fleas. It's got, you know, it's just unsanitary. I don't want this dog in the building. So he says, you know, it's just a really big disturbance to everybody else. And I just can't have this dog in this building. So you're going to have to get rid of it. Otherwise, you're going to have to leave. I'm going to have to evict you because you're violating this lease. Other than being entirely unfair and awful, what can Bob do in that situation? The question I'd like to ask you is that Bob gets a notice on his door. Is that a situation in which he can request a reasonable accommodation once the landlord decides to initiate an eviction process? Yes. So that's something I'd want to leave you with too, is that if a landlord is trying to evict you for reasons directly connected to your disability, for example, in Bob's situation, his service animal is directly connected to his need for equal access to his housing, like that he needs to be able to navigate the housing the same way as somebody else. If it's directly connected, that is a place you can make a reasonable accommodation request to. You can make a reasonable accommodation request at any time during the eviction process. It, up till the time that it goes through the court system, until the sheriff comes to your door and pulls you out of that apartment, you can make reasonable accommodation requests to say, to ask for a waiver of a policy that a landlord has in place. To say, I need you to waive that policy because it's directly connected to my disability and that's the grounds on which you're evicting me. Or, for example, or I need time. In some situations, you need time to be able to comply with the lease. So hold off on the eviction proceeding. And I can come into compliance with the lease because it's connected. Because it's something that's connected to my disability. That often happens in situations where folks have mental disabilities, Go ahead. Mm-hmm. On the my left toward the wall. Mm-hmm. And so you said often a tenant moves in a situation that's adversarial to the landlord. Is there a question?
Isn't that what usually happens?
It depends. There are a lot of reasons why somebody may want to stay in their existing unit, and it is a very personal decision. There's a lot of reasons why somebody would want to leave because, you know what, I really just don't like dealing with this person anymore. I don't like this person. They make my housing situation very, very difficult. But that's very personal. But there's plenty of situations that people do want to stay in the housing that they're in. On the left side here.
This is my last question.
And then I'll come back to you. Go ahead.
The water's going to be shut off from noon to 4, and they posted a notice on the board. I have requested that my landlord or someone in the office give me a call and leave a message on my answering machine that the water's going to be shut off, and they say that is an undue administrative burden. Where do we go from there?
Well, they're pressing the issue. Maybe they have to go.
Again, So who determines this, who determines whether it's reasonable? It's, again, a lot of this is factual, right? And I don't know that a phone call is very expensive, or is it a very high, yeah, or time consuming. And but you may have to indicate how the accommodation is related to your disability, what you're requesting. Sure. Yeah. So that's, there you go. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know that that's the situation. And a phone call or a waiver of a pet policy, like a waiver of a pet policy, for example, if they can accept a service animal, they could probably accept a phone call. But it seems like that would be reasonable. Again, I would have to know more about the situation. But the thing is that, they can ask you, you know, how is this connected? Why is this the situation? But if it's that you can't read the notice, you know, on this side, there was a question. Oh, wait, there was one woman, I'm sorry, before you. Apologize. I mean, sure. Insofar as it affects your housing, if it makes it impossible for your friends to come visit you, but you can ask that from your landlord. You don't have to be the person with the disability in order to make an accommodation request on behalf of a person with a disability. So this often happens in situations, maybe mom and child live together in a unit, but child has a disability, mom doesn't. Mom totally has the right to ask for accommodation on behalf of her child. Or if you have a friend that you can ask for an accommodation on behalf of that friend. Again, I'm not.
I guess I'm also going to say that the California Civil Code 54, Section 54, would cover that. The question was, could somebody, you don't have a service animal, but you have visitors, friends, mm-hmm. relatives that come over to visit you with a service animal. Is it legal? Do you have to make a certain request? And I'm saying is that there's a variety of different laws, but the Civil Code, California Civil Code, Section 54, addresses that. I know that from firsthand experience. I worked on the legislation back in the mid-70s. I was dating somebody who had a service animal, and she came over one time for service animal. There was a knock on the door, and the property management people said, "Your friend can't stay here and visit you because she has a service animal." I checked into it, found out it was all legal, got that changed, and that is something that you do have a right of visitors come in here, and the ADA would also cover that. But then the ADA, certain areas doesn't, you know, always address depending on the funding, but the Civil Code would cover that. So you can have people come and visit you with a service animal. I think there was another question.
There's one question on the side right here over near the wall. Sure. I was just discussing during the, if someone puts a notice on your door and it's and they're trying to evict you for a reason connected directly with your disability, for example, your service animal is, I'm sorry, I don't know if someone's talking, but your service animal is is almost like an assistive device to anybody else who that directly connects with your disability and assists you with navigating the building, general surroundings, et cetera. And if that's the reason, you can even make an accommodation request at that point. Say, I mean, here's the deal. Say the housing provider just didn't even know that you had an animal for this long, but it is a service animal, or look the other way, et cetera, but now decides that it's not okay anymore because he discovers it one day or pretends he discovers it one day even though he's seen it all along, et cetera. You've never made an actual accommodation request regarding this animal. Is it stronger to the court if you've made an accommodation request before and if you've had a history? Sure. But does that stop you from making accommodation requests now that you haven't made one all along? No. You can do that then also and ask that a court rule on that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay. If I just might add one more thing. I have CDs of the presentation that I made today, and it has more actually on requesting accommodations during eviction, et cetera. I know I handed them out a little bit earlier, but if anybody doesn't have one, if you raise your hand, I'll come by and happy to pass one out.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Okay. We will now have a opportunity to hear about your rights to have access to human care, and also just your basic rights to reasonable modifications you can make in a healthcare setting. And we have our next presenter, also from Disability Rights Legal Center,
John.
I got your first name right. Love. You want it?
Sure. It's a rather long name, and it was long to begin with, and then I got married a few years ago, and my wife and I combined our names and making it even longer and more difficult and a really long email address as well. But before we get started, we have a hand up for a question. Yes. Oh, okay, for material, okay. Just passing out material. So, again, keep your hand up if you need a copy of Sri's presentation material. And she'll walk around and give that to you. Thank you. But my name is John, and it was John Longoria, which many of you now may be familiar in terms of the surname because of Eva Longoria, and I'm tired of getting asked for her telephone number. I'm not related. I wish I was, but I do use it to my advantage at times. So, and actually, you know, I can't say they were not. Somewhere along the line, because she bears uncanny resemblance to a few of my female family members, especially the cutest nieces you've ever seen look just like her. But in any case, when I got married, combined my name with my wife, who's Mary Caviat, who's a judge at the Superior Court, and now we compromised, and I totally empathize with women who go through that process and change their name in terms of what a hassle that is, in terms of changing, you know, driver's license, passports, everything like that, and then, you know, everything that follows that in terms of tracking you. But now it's John Viard de Longoria, so, but one and the same. So I apologize. Even Eugene had a hard time getting communication with me because of the changing email addresses and it not getting to me, so I apologize for that. But thank CCB. And Eugene and Donna and everyone else that is putting on this conference. I know it's a lot of work, but it's vital in terms of the information that they share and the resources in terms of their exhibitors, in terms of you know, how to go about and make yourself an advocate for yourselves and for everyone else in this room and everybody else with disabilities, not only visual disabilities, but all sorts of disabilities out in the community in terms of enforcing the ADA and other access and non-discrimination laws. But I'm with, as Eugene said, and Shri said, with Disability Rights Legal Center, and hopefully I was out of the room, but I'm sure she gave you a quick background. If you're not familiar with our organization, I'll repeat it. We're a nonprofit civil rights organization. We were, up to recently, located for many years out of Loyola Law School in downtown Los Angeles. We just relocated. Oh, yes. Out of Los Angeles. We're now in the corner of 8th and Figueroa, around the corner from the Staples Center. But just so you're aware, we're not a walk-in center. We're not your typical legal aid office. We do mostly assist clients through our telephone intake line, and you'll have information and that number available. We have a resource table in the exhibit area, and I don't know it offhand, but we'll get it to you. I should know that, but I just know my personal extension, and but we'll give that to you. Do you know it, Sri?
The
intake number?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, our general intake number is 213-736-1334. And again, we have, 213-736-1334, and it'll be in the material that you'll be receiving in terms of being distributed today. So maybe Sri can help me. There's copies of CDs at the end of the table. Go around the room right now and pass you one of them. So what we do is focus on your civil rights. We don't assist with entitlement issues and things like that. So, again, our concern, our focus is on your civil rights in terms of not being discriminated against in all sorts of settings. Today's workshop is focused on your rights in terms of healthcare access. Is that a hand up, or are you just raising it for materials? She'll be passing out to everyone because no one's received that yet. So if you hold on for a second. So, but by I knew Eugene asked to speak a little bit about myself. Just really quickly, I do have some public service experience. I work for LA County Supervisor Molina in terms of being a senior deputy to her. I also work for as a district director for a state assembly person. And so, and for many years for Legal Aid Foundation, a more traditional legal aid organization, and also public counsel. So I have a good background in terms of the frustration folks feel and acts of discrimination against people that are often marginalized in our communities and in our society, not only in Los Angeles, but the country. And also how difficult it is for policymakers oftentimes in terms of formulating policy and getting it right. So it's absolutely vital in terms of becoming aware and building knowledge base in terms of your rights, but also for being strong advocates for those rights. And I know CCB, you know, leads the charge here in California and locally and at the federal level, National Council of the Blind and other organizations. But every individual here needs to join if you're not one of those organizations and be an a spoken advocate at different levels. So I can't underscore that enough in terms of the importance of that. So today's presentation, give you just general information. People's knowledge base may vary, so I apologize in advance if it's too basic, but we just want to cover some of the basic elements in terms of the laws. And again, if you hold on to your questions towards the end, we'll have time to answer those questions and also go through some examples and exercises and get your solutions, practical solutions, and how you would handle it, identify the problem and possible solutions. Okay? Okay. But as a person with a disability, you have the right to equal access to healthcare services. That's a general mantra that you should come away today knowing, which includes the removal of most physical barriers that make it difficult for you to enter and use healthcare facilities. Everything from, you know, pathways, entrances, rooms, exam rooms, signage, and things like that. That, again, sometimes there's been a, and I won't say overemphasis, but again, a long struggle in terms of just physical accessibility that, you know, even after 20-some years of passage, and even before then, California access laws, there are still buildings today, even new buildings, that don't meet the code. So, and it's important to know that there's no access police going out there. You know, you are the actual access police and enforcers by noting barriers, whether they're physical barriers or program barriers, making you know, the agency, whether it's a healthcare provider or a government agency, nonprofit agency, whoever's providing that service or where that facility is located, in terms of the making them aware of the barrier, okay? And if need be, filing a complaint. And we'll go through some of the options in terms of doing that. But again, I can't emphasize that enough in terms of your role as an advocate and enforcer of equal access to benefits and services and facilities, okay? One second, my PowerPoint is jumping around. Okay. Yes?
I work for a provider.
A medical care provider?
Well, I work for a healthcare HMO with Kaiser.
Mm-hmm.
I work as a medical transfer over in there. I get very good care. My thing is, though, as far as the signage, how do I get to the places in there? There's family practice. West LA Center is what I'm talking about, because there's others too, but family practice and this and that and whatever. Nothing in Braille. The elevators are in Braille. Where I work for Kaiser, which is on Robertson, they medical transcription, there's a sign that way in Braille saying this, but what about where the different areas like Leeds, Lab,
hold on to that.
Yeah. Okay, I will. If we can hold off that question until after John finishes his presentation, and also just to let you know, since you brought up that, if you would check the California Connection. The recent one, there was an announcement. Disability rights advocates and CCB are now going to be entering structured negotiations with Kaiser, and this is an item that would want to be brought up. So follow that, because it'll be a contact phone number for you to contact to gather that information to bring your issue up. But let's hold off with questions, and then our speaker will repeat when John's ready for questions. He will repeat the question so everyone in the audience can hear. Thank you.
Thank you. I noted your question, and we'll answer it after the presentation. But I want to get through this so we can answer your questions and hopefully have some solutions for that. Okay. So again, people are familiar with in terms of the physical access and removal of physical barriers, and again, important in terms of equipment, medical equipment across the board for people with all sorts of disabilities. That again, that's been ongoing and continues to be a barrier that needs to be addressed. But specifically for persons with blindness or visual impairments, you have the right to auxiliary aids and services free of charge if you need one for effective communication with your provider, okay? So what does that mean? It means the right to healthcare information in alternative formats that work for you, okay? And that can be, it can mean different things for different people, right? It can mean large print, it can mean Braille, it can mean audio, and different formatted materials. So there's not one solution fits all. And it's very personalized inquiry and solution to that, okay? And obviously, and we know, you would think this would not continue to be a problem, but the right to be accompanied by your service animal when you visit a healthcare facility. Show of hands, anyone who still has faced that problem in terms of entering, you know, medical care settings. I thought that was somebody's whistling, but that's somebody's phone going off, right? Okay. Okay. Yeah, please, if you can do that. But unless you're expecting some emergency or urgent call, I understand that. But appreciate that. Okay? But just as I said, just as you are knowing your rights and responsibilities, just as you're the expert on your body, and all of us need to take responsibility for that. I don't know how many times we want to hand that off to medical professionals that sometimes don't know us, don't know our complete history. So it's really important that you be self-advocates in terms of your medical care and make sure that you're informing them of your history, your special needs, and also that you know your rights under the Americans with Disability Act and other state laws that protect you from discrimination again, and help you can get equal access to quality health care. Okay. Just briefly, we won't go into all the laws, but, you know, laws governing equal access to health care services include, you know, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which prohibits any organization that receives federal financial assistance from denying individuals with disability equal access to services it offers. So, you know, almost virtually every hospital, clinic, and healthcare agency that accepts Medi-Cal, Medicare, or any other form of funding must comply with the rehab requirement, which essentially says no otherwise qualified individual with a disability shall solely by reason of his or her disability be excluded from participation in, be denied benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So, again, so even if they receive one Medicare or Medi-Cal patient, that provider's entire operation must comply with the Rehab Act. Medicare and Medi-Cal managed care plans must also provide accessible care to enrollees. Okay. Obviously, the ADA, which was passed in 1990, and both Title II, which extends the Rehab Act requirements to all state and local government activities. So think about, you know, county healthcare agencies and all their different programs and services and their private vendors who they contract out with. They also are required and may not discriminate on the basis of disability, okay? As well as Title III of the ADA, which indicates no individual shall be discriminated against on the basis of disability and the full equal enjoyment of goods and services, facilities, privileges, advantages, or accommodations by any place of a public accommodation. So any business, a private doctor, private pharmacy, you know, optometrist that's open as a business to the general needs to make accommodations and not discriminate against people with disabilities. And Under the Civil Rights Act here in California. And show of hands, I'm assuming most folks are here from California. Some outsiders as well? Okay. Sense, right, Eugene?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And so we're lucky in many respects in terms of the additional protections. And I didn't know, but I want to applaud and, you know, acknowledge Eugene's role in terms of policy and legislative advocacy to get that done in many ways. So, so they protect, again, people who are qualified, and it shouldn't, and thank goodness for the ADA Amendments Act, made it a lot clearer and easier in terms of who's protected, or letting the courts know and entities know that it's a pretty broad definition, and they shouldn't go on a fishing and expedition and propose, you know, onerous requirements in terms of proving disability to get you covered, okay? But the ADA is only enforced if you bring barriers to the attention of healthcare providers, like I said. And in many cases, you know, hard to believe, they're completely ignorant of their requirements and of scoping requirements and of accessibility things. And it requires someone to bring it to their attention oftentimes, and they won't know unless you tell them. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in the form of a complaint initially, but Notice, obviously, is important. Written notice is always the best. You can document, you know, date, time, and that you provided them notice. But we understand, and it's quite natural. You don't want an adversarial relationship with your medical care provider. You know, I hate to question doctors when I go in there, and for fear that, you know, they may resent me for some reason, or say, yeah, I'd like a second opinion. Nobody, you know, likes to be questioned and put to task. But again, when your health care is at stake and your rights are at stake, it's something that you should insist on, and don't be embarrassed or hesitant to do. Okay, so you can use ADA as a tool to improve the quality of care you receive. So if you're experiencing problems with access, it's your responsibility to speak up and take action. And we understand the first step is, you know, sometimes the hardest step. So when you see a problem or know you're not getting equal access to care, what are you going to do? We have many reasons why we don't. You're too sick sometimes, right? You're not feeling well. That's why you're trying to get medical care. Or you don't know where to start or how to ask for a change. Or you might, again, be fearful that you might anger or insult your healthcare provider who you know, might punish you, retaliate in some way. So those are all legitimate feelings of concern, but you may feel it's too much work, it takes too much time, possibly, you know, some money, it can take a long time to get things done, or you assume someone else will do it. But to tell the truth, the only good reason is the first one. If you're really not feeling well and you need somebody to step in and advocate on your behalf. But if you don't think of yourself as a change agent and an advocate for assertive person, there are things you can do to make things better, okay? Your goal, again, is your good health, and it requires getting equal access to health care, okay? So it starts even before you're making your medical appointments or choosing your medical providers. What can be done, okay? And I'm sure a lot of you implement these tools in terms of doing that, but is being informed, right? Calling and finding out and developing strategies that will help you to address the most common types of program service-related barriers or physical barriers that you may encounter in obtaining medical needed services. So knowing about the facility, if you don't know, calling up and asking, do you have accessible parking, accessible entrances, do you have material in alternative formats, this is what I need, and here are a few examples, okay? You can tailor them to address your needs and be prepared that staffs do not know the answer to the questions, so you can tell them about resources so they can get the answers, okay? You know, obviously parking, there's never enough. So we realize that, along with the abuse of placards, we realize that that's a, you know, ongoing problem as well. But just to be cautious, because I do a lot of presentation to business entities and providers, and that's one of the things. Well, people, you know, are taking it. You know, they seem healthy. They, you know, they don't. They're not wheelchair users. Why are they using accessible parking space? And we have to explain that. Oftentimes, you don't know. Right? It's not readily apparent in terms of that person's you know, impairments or limitations that may require or their need for an accessible parking space. So, but at the same time, we realize there's abuse of the system, but, you know, they have to revise it to increase the formula. But just so you know, it, you know, the general formula, it's 10% of parking spaces, and if they're focused in on providing a patient population of those that have mobility impairments, it can get up to 20% of the accessible or the parking spaces that they have at their facility. Okay, so you know on a personal level, visiting facilities, what the most common types of barriers you face, just physical barriers. Elevators? Okay, the lack of or signage?
Unlabeled,
right? What are some other physical barriers that still present some challenges? Anyone? No elevators, right? Signage is a big thing for the most part, right? Signage to the entrances, signage to the elevators, the restrooms, and the offices. And we'll get to your question a little bit in terms of signage. And the woman who asked, you know, they also have responsibilities in terms of employee accommodations, right? If you're an employee, in terms of what you need in terms of accommodation to be able to function and do your job there at a Kaiser facility or any other Kaiser facility. You know, DRA had a landmark lawsuit and settlement against the Kaiser facilities, and it's good to hear that, again, they have ongoing negotiations and discussions with them in terms of improving accessibility, and you're right. They should need and have to have your input in terms of improvements. And there's a gray area in terms of what's required and what's actually best practices, right? And so people need to realize, do they have to put, you know, tactile braille signage on everything? No, you know. And I think people realize that. But in terms of common areas, critical areas that, you know, need to be identified, that obviously should happen, needs to happen, but somebody needs to identify those, right? They should have an employee group and also a community patient group that advises them and lets them know and makes recommendations to that extent because, again, they may be unaware in terms of what's needed and what are the priorities in terms of signage. Sample questions that you can ask if it's a new provider trying to get their accessible parking spaces, inside access and accessibility in terms of inside the medical office, elevators, accessible restrooms. So if they don't have that, you know, you can ask, do you have adequate signage? If you don't, you know, can you give me, you know, specific directions too that'll help me get in there? And then, you know, a note, can you bring it to the attention of the building management company that this is needed or is not in compliance, okay? You know, equipment, if it's available or needed in the office. Or if they, you know, do they have experience treating patients who are blind or have low vision? That'll give you a cue right away in terms of, you know, they may not be prepared in terms of your particular needs, okay? Forms. We heard in terms of the housing situation, and everyone knows it comes into play in terms of medical care and visits, right? Authorizations, consent forms, financial liability forms, and what are some of the solutions that people here employ and have or have had providers that are good providers and solutions to that? Anyone? Yes. Very good. How about anyone else? In terms of signing forms, let's say you go in and they, you know, have a three-page questionnaire and consent forms. Yes. Exactly. That's a very big and you know, serious violation in terms of HIPAA and everything else in terms of confidentiality. But you do have a right, again, if they don't have alternative formatted forms, to have you, if that's your best means of understanding the forms, to have them read it to you. But, again, insist on a private area that is confidential, not in the, you know, earshot of the general reception area, other patients. Yes, I hand up to my left there.
I also have Kaiser insurance, and my question centers on choice of treatment. And I had to go in for a cardiac evaluation, and the nurse in charge of the cardiac lab was refusing to allow me the treadmill test.
assessment.
Right. A very good point. Again, they can't generalize. Again, I apologize. She also has Kaiser as a medical care provider, and in terms of her election of a particular examination and procedure, they didn't want to have her use a treadmill for a particular exam because of the fear that a liability of accident because of her blindness. And that was her preference. The other alternative was a chemical exam that they she did not want to undergo. And apparently she protested and was able to convince them that, again, she had the right to have that exam of her choice. Yes. Let me finish just that point. That, again, it's very individualized. And people should realize that, again, we don't mind people sharing. And we hope that everything that is said here is confidential. And but thank you for sharing if you choose to do that. But please respect people's privacy in terms of anything that's said here. If they, this is a common courtesy. Question on my left, yes. Two questions, but yes, your hand up. And then the next one, yes.
Mm-hmm. But so what I suggest with everybody is be prepared to explain and have the temper stuff with you, you know. Like, for example, I use a post-it I haven't put on there, so it's not going to move anywhere. So already have that in hand, or simple, really quick instructions. I think a lot of times what they get worried about is they haven't seen a blind person before, and the other thing too, also suggest. They tell us to get there early to fill out forms. Now, I let them know ahead of time. I will need assistance in forms. I set it up ahead of time. And sometimes I think that's a good idea. You know, it depends on the situation. But the citing is really, really important. You know what method you need to use to tell them how to sign the forms.
Great. Very good point in terms of being the advocate and things that you can do ahead of time to facilitate adequate service. Yes, a question, the black sweater in front of me with her hand up. Yes. Right. Sure, it wasn't really a question, but she, in terms of a comment, in her experience, in the Blue Shield, I believe, was one of her healthcare providers, issues regarding privacy and also, I guess, the effectiveness of communication by staff, and also in terms of, what is maybe overly broad in terms of information that may be asked or needed for a particular procedure.
What do you do about that when the people don't speak very good English?
You want to, obviously communicate that you have, you don't understand by way of, it can be accents, it could just be, other things where, again, if they have another staff person that can assist you because you're having difficulties understanding and communicating with the person that's assisting you at the moment, right? Again, not a foolproof solution to that, but you can only do what you can do. But that's beyond the scope of, discrimination in terms of disability accessibility. But again, that's more and more of a commonplace in terms of, just our culture and the change in, I'm just getting up to grab my water, which I left over here, in terms of the diversity we have. And we hope that it makes us a little sensitive and appreciative of folks, you know, with different cultures and language. But again, what is critically important is the effectiveness of communication, right? You're going in there for medical care. So you need to be spot on in terms of the information that's related, that you need to relate to them, and that they need to relate to you in terms of your care. So if you're not satisfied with that, you say, time out, you know, we need to start over, or let me repeat this, or, you know, I think that's going too far. Why do you need that for, you know, for this particular exam or procedure, right? Okay, so don't be afraid to, you know, question and then say, yeah, and I do that at medical appointments. Do you really need to know that? I don't, you know, I don't want to answer that. Or I leave, put NA on forms, or, you know, I say, you know, it really not pertinent to this particular visit or our discussion. I don't like answering, you know, general questions in terms of about my health. Unless, again, I understand they need background. If you have, if you're allergic to particular medications, or, you know, in terms of symptoms, you know, you have to, again, be reasonable and understand that it may affect your consultation and your treatment. So, again, but if it's overly broad or so, you know, out of touch in terms of what you think is, you can question them about it and say, why do you need that information, right? Okay, thank you.
John?
Yes.
Excuse me. What I find when there's a difficulty in those communications, that A, you cannot rely on the information that the person is putting on the paper is accurate, and that there are cultural biases about disability, and you know, they put what they think you should put there, not what is actual.
Right. And that's a fact that happens, and it's an element that, for better or worse, we have to recognize that both by human nature and their experience, a lot of folks don't have, you know, knowledge base and experience in terms of people with not only blindness or visual impairments, but other disabilities. They have misconceptions in terms of abilities, what your restrictions are, what your needs are, and what works for you. So again, it always seems to come back, you're your best advocate in terms of clarifying what works for you, what you need, and what you need to communicate. And don't let that slip by in any sort of way, especially in medical care settings. We have two questions, and we'll still go on in terms of, you know, authorizations and forms and things, how to clarify and get that better responded to. A question to my left. Or to my right. Yes.
I think also the most common problem I have is in signing forms and filling out forms and also getting information on paper about procedures. You know, I have a minor surgery procedure. Okay, here's a sheet of paper. Here's what you have to do. And I say, well, can you explain that? Which would be a reasonable question. Work partially cited. I've heard everything from we don't have time. And I think in a lot of cases they really don't, but then my question is, why is it that a blind person is the one that's shouted about somebody else? But, and what they're sort of saying is that that's an undue burden for us to spend all that time reading those forms and filling them out for you and explaining procedures that we can just hand to a paper. How do you counter that? I mean, what they're really saying is, we don't want to do it. I mean, other than voting with my feet, which I have done, what do you suggest we do?
Repeat it.
Just asking for an accommodation, explaining why you do it doesn't work.
Right. She's essentially asking in terms of, you know, what's a common experience of providers simply saying it's too much trouble. It takes too long. We don't have alternative format material. We have to rush through this. We don't have time. And what do you do in those circumstances? That's not a defense. You know, it's not an undue administrative or financial burden. That's not a legal defense. If you need, especially if you're going for a surgical procedure or something like that, right? But it doesn't have to even raise to that level. It's, you know, what the prognosis, diagnosis, the prescriptions, all that is critical information. And so, again, if you're not satisfied, you shouldn't rush into it. Take medication that you don't understand the risk. risk, if they don't explain that to you, for whatever reason, they don't have time, or the explanation you feel is too rushed, or they didn't do a thorough job of explaining all the paperwork, you have to say, no, you know, stop, I need this. One, I need it in an alternative format, right? This is what I need it in. I need it in large print, or I need an audio cassette of it, or I need it in CD format before we can go further, right? But again, depending what works at the moment, and again, timing is an element. So again, if you're going into surgery, obviously it's not going to be overnight unless it's an emergency surgery. So you need to take the time, have them provide it, and it has to be reasonable. You know, most offices don't have material in alternative formats, so you can assist them beforehand. And one of the great things about the conference here is you have exhibitors out there that have assistive technology that should be you know, purchased and utilized by medical care providers in their facilities to help that communication. And part of the role that DRLC plays and other advocates play is, you know, we go out and provide training to medical care providers to let them know that that's a problem, that's a violation, or it could be a violation. And also teaching them, you know, what resources are out there that facilitate communication, whether it be for the hearing impaired, the visually impaired, and the obligation to accommodate that. So, again, I hate to sound like a record, but it's an ongoing job that each of us has in terms of advocating for ourselves, making them understand what our needs are, and not moving forward until we receive the accommodation or the communication that we need to move forward with our, you know, medical care. Again, question in front of me with your hand up. Yes.
Is that me?
Yes. Good. And again, a comment that, again, there are really quick and easy fixes to a lot of these things. And but they may be unaware of that. You let them know you have these forms, you have electronic versions of these forms. You can download it or download it on a memory stick that I can use on my laptop or of other assistive device. And they have plenty out there. And I'm not familiar with the entirety of that, but they have so much technology out there that they can use already. And it's not, you know, prohibitively expensive. So again, it's a matter of education. But again, also insisting that what works for me and what I need in terms of alternative formats. And here are some tools. This will work for me. Can you download it? Can you email it to me so I can look at it beforehand and review it? Okay? Again, be prepared to offer solutions. That's it. If you did this, it would be much easier for me to get the services or what I need. Okay? And if you're not comfortable speaking with someone about the issue during your visit, or there's not an opportunity to do that, you can also get results from, you know, writing a letter. And in the CD, there's a sample letter that you can use, adapted to your particular issue. And again, we understand that, again, some folks may be uncomfortable in terms of raising issues at the time. But things are not going to get corrected unless we bring it to their attention and demand that they, you know, provide a response. Okay, and correct that in terms of their policies and procedure. Okay, but you need to be specific and provide specific information about what accommodation you need. So be persistent, strong, and clear. Don't accept "we'll look into it" or, you know, "we'll follow up" and never get that. Tell them, "I'll call you in a week," "I'll call you in a month," or "by my next appointment time, you know, I want this, I want a response, an answer, or a change." Okay? And unless you do that, you know, and they are. The unfortunate thing is, I think most are well intentioned and they want to do the good thing and the right thing. But, you know, if anyone goes to medical appointments, it's somewhat a mill, right? They run you in, you have 5 minutes, and they're rushing you out. Accommodation is, I need more time, You know, I need more time with your nurse, the front desk, explain things with the doctor. So be sure to book me for an extended appointment time. Okay, that's the accommodation that I need, if that's what it is. Okay, few resources. Obviously, ART Center, and again, I'm glad I put this down in the material that you have. But our 800 or 866 toll free number is 866-999-DRLC. Other resources, connect with obviously your organization here, California Council of the Blind. If you're connected with your local independent living center, they're scattered throughout LA County and throughout the state. We work with many of them. The one for the greater central LA area is Cal Life, Communities Actively Living Independently Free. And they're great resources and a way of advocating in terms of your local community and bringing issues to light in terms of what needs to be done. Obviously, if it proceeds, if they don't take any action, ignore your request, or their ongoing problems, or they're so egregious, you may have to step it up, file a discrimination complaint. It can be with the Department of Justice or California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing Agency, and letting them know and CCing the doctor's office. So there's information in terms of that process, who to contact, and how do you do that. Yes, a question on this side.
We recently went to Target, and I guess we're in the age of the touch screen now.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been being prepared, you can't fill the touch screen because it's just black. And she didn't really want to work with the touch screen. The lady said they're not obligated to have a point that you can visually fill.
Yeah, are you talking about the question was that you visited Target recently and they had a touch screen. Was it a point of sale or pharmacy?
It's for your debit card.
Oh, kind of point of sale, checkout, self-checkout.
That you really need to get in contact with Lenny Feingold,
yes.
Linda Dardarian. They are working on that, the structure negotiations with Target and other places. So contact the CCB office, 1-800-221-6359. And contact them, and they'll get you the phone number to get hold of Lainey and Linda. So that is something they need to get that feedback. Thank you.
Right. And again, it applies in other settings. But again, it's the age now that everything is, less labor-intensive and more electronic. And again, those are challenges that are coming up just with like website accessibility. That can, unfortunately, it's going to take complaints and lawsuits to get in different industries compliant, right? And develop non-discriminatory means for people with all sorts of disabilities. Yes, another question, Tila. Right, and that's one of the points in his comment was that, again, you're not alone. Because of the increasing population of seniors and people with disabilities, for a lot of reasons, but one of the major reasons in terms of the aging of the baby boomer population, now I think the latest stat from AARP was that 10,000 people per day are becoming seniors after this last new year. So along with that, you have good allies, and although traditionally a lot of folks and seniors, like my mother, who's 4 years old now, doesn't regard herself as a disability, but has a cancer survivor, has a liver transplant patient, has problems with mobility, has problems hearing, doesn't identify herself as a person with disability. But you join forces in so many ways in terms of the same issues and challenges out there in terms of accessibility and discrimination. So you're right in terms of connecting, advocating with, and some of the same issues are being fought by other groups and, collaborating with them and making sure that your particular issues are addressed and heard at the table and there are obviously a tremendous lobbying group with vast resources, and that traditionally politicians understand and respond to, unfortunately, a lot more than subgroups of people with disabilities. Okay, so it's your health, your choice, your voice. You got to not give up, make a difference, and you know, be your best advocate. So let me just tell you, and hopefully, we had enough CDs for everyone. If not, we did? Great. We'll make some available, or if you want copies or additional copies, contact our office, and we'll get that to you. But just to let you know, some of the things are that are on the CD are resources for providers. Again, part of the solution is we need to educate providers. So there's information you can download from the CD and give them in terms of resources for providing information in alternative formats, how to get things translated into Braille, accessible technology, practices, best practices, service animals. There's a sample accommodation letter. And what? Last but not least, we really would appreciate it if, at your convenience, you get home, play that, or put that CD in your computer. There's an evaluation form that you can copy and send to us via email that will help us in terms of future trainings and presentations, so understanding what your issues, if there's other issues that we didn't cover, what you like cover, and also a way to communicate with us and get on our mailing list so you can get updates in terms of what we're up to and in terms of advocacy on your behalf. So any other lingering questions that we want to address? Yes, in front of me, and then at the table. Yes. Yes.
I think
yes. Yes. Right, they do have technology. They have little tags in terms of that you can scan as well, different types of labeling. If that's not happening in your particular pharmacy, you need to insist that in terms of what you need in terms of formatted material for your medication. Obviously, and I think Eugene wanted to comment here, but there's different technology out there existing that they can utilize for identification of medication. But also in terms of the dosage and everything else.
Are you getting your prescriptions at Kaiser?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You can ask your pharmacist there at Kaiser for the talking prescription bottles. They will provide them. You get your bottle. It's there's at the base of it. There's a little device with a little button there, and the pharmacist has recorded the information that is on that prescription. So please pursue that. Talking to them. If you have a problem, again, get in contact with DRA, or you can do it through CC, and we will relay that information. But they do need that information very much. Yes. Talking prescription bottle, and they're provided. That's a benefit that Kaiser patients are eligible to get.
Yeah,
in Southern. Oh, go ahead, Mitch.
Since Kaiser is now charging $10 more to pick up a prescription in person than they do if you go through the mail order, Barbara, if you use the mail order service, they will provide it. Honest, there have been some issues with the bases not always fitting the
bottle very well, but I get all of my prescriptions that way, and you can talk to someone through their mail order center, and they know what you're talking about. It may take one or two times for them to get it right, but they do provide the talking RX bottle through the mail order center, and it is cheaper than going to the pharmacy personally to get prescriptions. They're trying to shut down all their pharmacies, or at least keep their numbers down in terms of patient load.
Right, thank you, Gene. Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch. Yes. And first, Bernice had a question.
You have a microphone? Okay.
Yeah, got it.
Okay. John, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but on the web, under the American Foundation for the Blind, AFB.org, there are two documents. One is responsibilities of medical providers, and the other one is responsibilities for hotel, motel. that list what they are supposed to provide to people who are blind or visually impaired under the ADA. And you can download those and hand them to your medical provider or whatever, and become familiar with what it says in there as to what you have the right to ask for.
And Kenneth, you have the last question, then I'll let John wrap it up because we have to move on.
No, go ahead.
Okay. There's no mic.
Yeah, I talked about that. It's not a question. I was just going to say for anyone down here in Southern Cal, if you need help, I'm willing to do it. I've helped several people with the cooking RX bottles. And so if anyone needs help with Kaiser stuff down here, just let me know. And I'll be glad to step in, and including the mail order.
Ken Metz was offering to assist anyone who might have any problems in getting the talking prescription bottles through Kaiser. He'd be willing to advise you since he has gone through that process. And again, even if it's successful and you're happy or not, either way, DRA really needs that information right now, because we're talking about structured negotiations for issues specifically for people with visual impairments. It's not a cross disability. It's to deal with visual impairments. John, would you like to say anything?
Yeah, just final words. I did include something from the American Council of the Blind in terms of a guide for medical providers, and it is on the CD, in terms of downloading a copy, emailing it to your provider, in terms of guidance, in terms of alternative formats and what have you. So, again, it's not an exhaustive list of resources or information, but some good basic ones that, again, need to take the responsibility, provide the provider to help them comply and also to better serve you. So, again, want to thank you. And also, don't forget, just like it was mentioned, you are your best resource in here. Everyone has come across these challenges and barriers and come up with solutions or knows of solutions. So use this opportunity to talk with folks, find out how they handled it, and about the resources out there. So can't stress that enough. So thank you again, and have a great remainder of the conference.
I want to thank John for that presentation very much. And we really appreciate the resources that we've had this morning from Disability Rights Legal Center. And we hope to continue working with them. And they are definitely an asset to many of you in Southern California for legal information on civil rights issues related to the disabled. Our next presenter, Larry?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Mr. Lawrence Rowland, who is, for the last 12 years, has been the coordinator of disabilities, the coordinator of access compliance for the Los Angeles LAX World Airport. and I believe that it also includes Ontario Airport. He'll correct me. Ms. Rowland has been working during this time period very closely with the disability community to ensure that the facilities and attendance, these airlines are complying with the ADA and the Air Carriers Air Carrier Access Act. And he will go over that act in a few minutes. Because of his efforts and what he's been doing for quite a while, he was honored in 2009 by becoming a recipient of the, quote, Spirit of Accessibility Award. And that's because of his efforts there. He's very committed to making certain that the airports in Los Angeles are accessible for persons with disabilities as well as visitors who are coming in to the airport. So let's please give him a hand.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I have a microphone here.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much. Let's start off. I'll give you a short presentation, and then I'll open it to questions, and hopefully I can answer them, and maybe some of you can share some of your horror stories, if any. But I assume that most of you have a great time when you fly, so there probably won't be many. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Lozano for the opportunity to be here today and present the talk, Visual Impairments Need Not Keep You from Traveling by Air.
Please, everyone, let's be courteous and give his attention.
Air travel is not without its horror stories for blind travelers. They are often refused admission on board an aircraft, arguments over seating, begrudging assistance, and finding their way through an unknown environment of the airport can be sometimes a real challenge. Recently, a group of blind air travelers filed a lawsuit against United Airlines claiming that the airline's digital kiosk are inaccessible to blind people, and I believe there were just some of you were just talking about that very issue. Among the problems is that many of the electronic kiosks are not accessible to the blind traveler because there is no earphone jack, no audio output, or braille output in many of the machines. Before I continue in my speech, a primary example. 2 years ago, I happened to go to a convention of the kiosk industry so that I could see what technology was available to, so we could put it at LAX and Ontario airports. Almost everybody was very proud to tell me that their equipment was ADA accessible. And then I asked them, please show me how it could be used if I were blind. They were speechless. Because to them, there are no blind people, I guess. Or they don't use the equipment. It was a real shock. It was a real shock and an embarrassment that I felt for them. But let me continue. Mike May, who lives in Davis, California, in an article that I was reading, says he has to ask strangers to look for flight information on the big digital boards and to check in using the now ubiquitous electronic kiosk is an even bigger hassle, at least at some of the airlines. To get around this problem, he often has to rely on strangers to do the process for him, and he ends up having to hand over his credit card information and other private information to them. Mr. May goes on to say it is demeaning to have to ask for this kind of service. And personally, I have watched this type of thing go on where an individual with a visual impairment was trying to use a kiosk at one of the terminals at LAX. And I observed the person, but I wanted to see how long it was going to be before somebody came up to actually provide assistance. About 10 minutes later, I said, that's ridiculous. So I ended up pulling somebody from behind the counter to come out and assist this poor person. I would have done it myself, except it would have been sort of like the blind leading the blind. I would have no idea how to use those machines. So I decided to get an expert to do that. But it's inexcusable. But these are only some of the observations and that are faced by air travelers with visual impairments. The problem actually starts before a traveler gets to the airport. A number of airline websites are inaccessible to blind people. The sites are incompatible with the screen readers that blind people use to serve the web. To surf the web. Those airlines effectively force blind individuals to buy tickets by phone, and they end up being overcharged, and they also end up having to pay higher fees, and they don't like waiving them. The solution is simple: design a website that blind people can use. The Rehabilitation Act of Section 508 talks about what a kiosk should be and how it should be made accessible. In addition to that, we also have the Air Carrier Access Act, which is commonly called the ACAA, and I'll be referring to that as ACAA. And then we have the ADA, and we also have regulations under California state law, and there's been legislation in effect for about 45 years now that stated that by January of 2010, in California, kiosks were supposed to be accessible. However, until about 2 weeks ago, airlines could get around the requirement by having by them stating that an individual will come up and help you with your ticket purchase or whatever happens to be at the airport. The reality, as I mentioned a little while ago, is something very different. If you start getting busy, you're not going to leave the customers at the counter. And the poor person that's standing there waiting for the service is going to be there indefinitely. So it's an unacceptable excuse. The U.S. Department of Transportation rule that sets out procedures designed to ensure travelers with disabilities are afforded the same rights and benefits as any other traveler is the ACAA. In other words, the ACAA is the ADA for aviation. That sets the rules that the airlines have to follow and the rules the airports have to follow. In addition, of course, you have the ADA that applies to certain functions within these facilities or within the airports, as well as which would be under Title II, and also Title III, which covers businesses. And Title II, by the way, is a governmental agency, which would be an airport. So the regulations are there. It's just a matter of making them stronger or having people demand their rights. Among some of the provisions in the ACAA useful for people with visual impairments that you should know about are the following. A person may not be refused transportation on the basis of a disability or be required to have an attendant to produce a medical certificate except in certain limited circumstances. And a visual impairment is not one of those circumstances. There should be no reason why you're denied boarding on an aircraft unless you have some severe medical condition that does not fit within the scope of being blind or having a visual impairment. Now, some foreign airlines do have some odd regulations about that, but if they're traveling to the United States or a connecting flight from the United States, they have to follow the ACAA, even though they are a foreign airline. That rule went into effect in 2010. But let's continue here. Airlines must provide in-planing, deplaning, and connecting assistance, including both personal and equipment. In other words, if you need assistance to get to the aircraft when you arrive, from the aircraft to the exit, you are entitled to that service. If you need assistance with your baggage, you are entitled to that service. This is covered by the Air Carrier Access Act. And it's something that, as I said, you are entitled to. It's not a privilege, it's a right. You're entitled to the same level of service as anybody else. Passengers with vision or hearing impairments must have timely access to the same information given to other passengers at the airport or on the plane concerning gate assignments, delayed flights, safety, etc. Carriers must allow service animals to accompany passengers in the cabin as long as they don't block the aisles or other emergency evacuation routes. And, of course, as long as they behave and a few other common sense things like that. If the service animal does not fit in the assigned location, the airline should relocate the passenger and the service animal to some other place in the cabin in the same class of service where the animal will fit under the seat. I'm sorry, under the seat of in front of the passenger and not create an obstruction such as a bulkhead. If no single seat in the cabin will accommodate the animal and passenger without causing an obstruction, travelers traveling on a later flight or having the service animal travel in the cargo area is an option. Airlines may not charge passengers with disabilities for services required by the ACAA, including transporting their oversized service animals in cargo compartments. Airlines may not deny transportation to the service animal on the basis that its carriage may offend or annoy any carrier personnel or persons traveling on the aircraft. There are some cultures that consider dogs to be unclean and they don't want to be around them, but that's their problem, not ours. So the service animal's entitled to the same rights as they would be. And maybe the animal thinks the same about the person but just doesn't say it. In determining if an animal is a service animal, the airline may ask, is this your pet? What task or function does your animal perform? Or would you describe how the animal performs this task or function? Legitimate questions they cannot ask you. So what's your disability? That's a no-no. I attended a lecture a while back, and the speaker happened to be a policeman dealing with some of the issues that they encounter in law enforcement and some of the dumb things that some of these policemen do. And he mentioned the incident where an individual goes into a store, I'm sorry, into a restaurant with a service animal, and he tells the manager there that the animal is a service animal. Well, the person says, well, you look perfectly fine to me. And he calls the police department. They come out, and he tells the person that needed the service animal that, you look fine to me. There's nothing wrong with you. Obviously, that was going to get somebody in a lot of hot water, and other problems would have occurred. But the fact is, because you have a disability or you say that you have a disability, regardless if it's obvious or not, you always assume the person has a disability under the ACAA. And if they can answer the questions, what function the service animal performs, it's usually quite obvious that it's that, not the pet. Whenever an airline decides not to accept an animal as a service animal, it must explain the reason for its decision and document it in writing. You must receive the written documentation at the airport or within 10 calendar days of the incident. So once again, if they tell you that they're convinced it's not a service animal and they're not going to let it on board, you must have something in writing either right there and then or within 10 calendar days. Airlines are never required to accommodate certain unusual service animals, such as snakes, other reptiles, ferrets, rodents, and spiders. As animals, as animals in the cabin, of course they could go underneath the plane, but with respect to all other animals, including unusual or exotic animals that are preserved, that are presented as service animal, example, miniature horses, pigs, and monkeys, the carrier must determine whether any factor precludes their traveling in the cabin as a service animal. Foreign carriers are only required to carry dogs as service animals. So if you're going to travel to, let's say, Europe, they only have to allow you to bring a they can refuse you your service alligator or whatever it happens to be. Yes, let me just finish and then we'll, you don't mind? I'm sorry, go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's right. I thought that the ADA changed the definition of a service animal to service dog, therefore others are no longer.
I'm glad you said that. But the ACAA is a different rule. I was going to mention that momentarily. Actually, I had it right here as my next item. But let me just go into that one. The question was that, the statement was that under the ADA that just came out, the only service animals are dogs. That is correct. However, in the ADA, it also says that for airlines and airports, the ACAA overrides. But let me continue on that same topic. Part two of the ADA, came out on 15 September 2011, reads in part regarding service animals. Some animals, such as certain non-human primates, including certain monkeys, pose a direct threat. Their behavior can be unpredictable, aggressive, and violent without notice or provocation. Having considered all of the comments about which species should qualify as service animals under the ADA, the department has determined that the most reasonable approach is to limit accessible species to dogs. The department has retained its position on the exclusion of emotional support animals from the definition of service animal. The definition states that the provision of emotional support, well-being, comfort, or companionship does not constitute work or task for the purpose of this definition. This rule does not affect rules under the ACA. So, though there's a difference in opinion, what I had heard originally after the rule came out was that the Department of Transportation was going to update their rules. But the latest thing I'm hearing is that they don't want to change. They want to maintain a variety of various animals. One of the more popular ones right now, besides the dog, is the service pony. And I've seen pictures of them right next to their owners there on board the plane. And it's amazing. But apparently they do a great job, and they last longer in their lifespan. Do take note, though, that to be a service animal that can properly travel in the cabin, the animal need not necessarily perform a function for the passenger during the flight. If the airline still feels that verbal assurance is not credible, they may require documentation. FAA safety rules establish standards for passengers allowed to sit in emergency exit rows, such as persons must be able to perform certain evacuation-related functions. If you need a specific seat assignment for yourself and your service animal, make your reservation as far in advance as you can and identify your need at the time. Remember, your seat may be reassigned if you fail to check in on time. Airlines typically release assigned seats not claimed within 30 minutes before scheduled departure. Airlines may not charge for services that are required by the ACAA. Airlines must make available a specifically trained compliance resolution officer, or a CRO, If a dispute arises, there must be a copy of the Department of Transportation rule at every airport. If you encounter a problem that is not being resolved, ask to speak to the CRO or the complaint resolution officer. How many of you were aware that there's such a thing?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Unfortunately, not many. Basically, this is what this is. When you go to the airport and you encounter some difficulty with the personnel there, ask to speak to a CRO. One of the problems that it's encountered is that many times employees don't know what they're talking about. And management doesn't train them in the regulations. I could tell you some nightmare stories, but it would take all day. So ask for the CRO. They have to have one.
And CRO stands for?
Complaints Resolution Officer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, I don't see anybody here that uses a wheelchair, but I will stay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, let me just mention that then, for in case you ever decide you need one to get through the airport. You can request wheelchair service. Mm-hmm. There is no charge. It is free. But when you make your reservations, it's when you should request it. Make certain that you ask for it. And also, remember, ask for your seat assignment. If you need a bulkhead because you need more room for yourself and your service animal, ask for that. It's free. No extra charge. Under the ACAA, everyone with a disability is entitled to request wheelchair assistance. And if necessary, other forms of assistance, such as a guide, to assist them through the terminal or to their gates. It is important that the traveler notifies their airline or travel agent when making their reservations about the special assistance that is needed. These services are provided by the air carrier free of charge. It is further recommended that you call the airline again at least 24 hours before your trip to reconfirm any assistance that you have requested. The carrier's assistance responsibility starts at the terminal entrance and goes through the airport to the gate for a passenger. Actually, it goes inside the aircraft until you're seated down. Upon request, the airline representative has to escort a passenger to a service relief area. What that means is, if you arrive and you're going to be going on a connecting flight somewhere else, and your service animal needs to use the restroom, you let the attendant know, and they are required to assist you and the service animal to the relief area or the restroom area for the service animal. Most airports, unfortunately, have the relief areas outside. But that's going to change. I'll go into that shortly. They have to go to the relief areas outside. When you come back in, you go to the front of the line, you'll get processed and go right back to the aircraft. So it's something that has to be done. A carrier, let's see, A carrier may not leave a passenger who has requested assistance required by the ACAA unattended by the personnel responsible for enplaning, deplaning, or connecting assistance in a ground wheelchair, boarding gear, or other device in which the passenger is not independently mobile for more than 30 minutes. This requirement applies even if another person in the family or care attendant is with you, unless you specifically state otherwise. And waive obligation. So what that means is, if you use a wheelchair and you can't get up and roam around independently for whatever reason, They have to come and check on you every 30 minutes to see that you don't need anything, such as going to get food or having to go to the restroom or whatever. You are in, they have to check with you every 30 minutes. That's the law. There, in most instances, what ends up happening, they drop you off. They forget you exist. That is not the way it works. Demand your rights. When checking at a ticket counter, notify the agent that you requested a wheelchair or, if appropriate, an assistant to get you to the gate. The attendant will be called and the appropriate service provided to you through security up to the aircraft. This process will be repeated on arrival and departure from your other location or from the other city that you're coming back from. When you travel abroad and you have a service animal, the rules are a little bit different. If the flight is 8 hours or longer, you have to certify that the animal will not go to the need to go to the bathroom during the flight. Because many of those flights from California would take maybe 11 hours or more. So they're presuming they're direct flights. So they just want to ensure that the dog won't go to the restroom on the plane. So that's the one big difference. Also, another difference is that you might have quarantine issues. Make certain you check way in advance to make certain you have all those issues resolved. In addition, if you're traveling to Hawaii, you must contact their quarantine people and make arrangements in advance. Otherwise, they can quarantine your service animal to ensure it doesn't have rabies or other illnesses. So it's part of planning. Plan ahead. It's an inconvenience, but you have to be prepared for all these issues. The Air Carrier Access Act now extends coverage to flights by foreign airlines originating or landing in the United States or ticketed through American carriers. Airlines are required to provide accommodations for people who travel with oxygen and other respiratory assistance, fly or who fly with service animals or have impaired hearing or vision. If a passenger is unable to use automated kiosk or check in or to check in or to print boarding passes, the airlines are required to provide assistance at the ticket kiosk or allow the passenger to go to the front of the line. Traveling overseas, however, can be difficult. In many countries, people with disabilities have very few rights. It's not until recent that the EU or the European Union came up with some regulations similar to our ADA. Some countries had them, but not all. They have them in place now. Canada, for example, has the Code of Practice Aircraft Accessibility for Persons with Disabilities.
Would you like, Larry? I think there's a glass back.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Travel, okay, so the regulations are there in some countries. Not all countries have them beyond that. Also, in some – well, I'll get to this one point I was going to make later on, but it's a significant one when I think. Non-American carriers that do not have partnership agreements with U.S. airlines or that do not fly in and out of the United States – oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Out of the United States are not subject to the American laws of the ADA or ACAA. When planning your trip, things to think about. Let the airline know if you require a wheelchair. If you need assistance getting into and out of the aircraft seat. If you require adjacent seats for yourself and your personal carrier care attendant. Are traveling with a service animal. Are traveling with a battery-powered medical device. Will need disassembly and battery packaging for your mobile assistance device or have any other special requirements. Keep in mind that if any of you use oxygen, you must give, usually it's between, it's usually around 72 hours advance notice if they're going to provide it. But you still have to give them advance notice. And if you provide your own oxygen, it has to be certified by the FAA as acceptable on board an aircraft. And the reason for that is of the pressure inside the airplane. You don't want to blow up the whole place because of the pressure expanding. So, and it'll also, otherwise it would also kill you. So you don't want that to happen. So make sure you let them know. And also, in the event they provide it, there's usually, like everything else, there's a charge. They run from $75 to $100 per leg of the flight. Advanced planning. Think about if you're going to travel to a foreign place, you may need immunizations. Get those things out of the way. To ensure that you have all your prescription drugs with you. if you have to carry syringes, make certain you bring the labeling with you that the pharmacist puts on there to ensure that you don't have any problems. Especially if you're going to travel overseas, bring your prescription bottles that have all the proper markings. Otherwise, they might suspect that you're doing something that's not necessarily correct or proper. Keep a record of the non-prescription drugs you're going to need to take with you. Some non-prescription drugs are not available in every country. So you might want to have those with you, too, if you need them. And how to reach local medical facilities or hospitals. One thing that I would recommend to everybody, and I don't think most people ever think about it, especially as you're younger, in my opinion, everybody should buy evacuation insurance. Evacuation insurance is assuming that you're on a trip and something serious happens to you. You get hit by a car and you're going to be demobilized for quite a while, or have a stroke or heart attack or heaven knows what else out there, but you're going to be seriously ill and you are going to be stuck in that foreign country for a long time. It's very expensive eventually in some countries, but even if it isn't expensive, you normally want to be back home with in the medical environment that you know, with your family, your loved ones. You feel much better than out in a foreign country by yourself, and then the people that you're with on your trip might have, you know, want to come back to take care of things while you're being rehabilitated or whatever. But with this evacuation insurance, what it does is that they provide a jet that's fully equipped with emergency equipment. It's basically an emergency room in the air. They'll provide a doctor if necessary. They provide a nurse, any medications that you would need, and they would transport you and your loved ones back to the United States. It usually costs about $30-some bucks, $40 for about a 3-week trip. It might be a little bit more. It might go as much as $60. It's been a while since I've used it, but it's worth. It's just security. It's worth it. Otherwise, it'll cost maybe about $150,000 out of your pocket to use those services to get home. So just something to keep in mind.
How do you get insurance?
Contact your insurance agent or check the web under some of the more reputable companies that you know, such as Travelers or Blue Cross. You know, they're out there. And just check with friends that have maybe gotten that insurance before. But definitely talk to your travel agent. They can, or your insurance agent, and they can refer you to a place. But check 2 or 3 places. The prices differ considerably between companies. And some of them will provide other things like insurance on your luggage and something happens to it. And if assume your luggage gets lost, they'll give you an allowance to buy clothing. And that's all provided as a freebie when you buy the insurance. So check around and do your homework. And it's worth it. To me, I mean, I won't travel overseas without it. like without leaving, I don't leave America without my American Express card. You know, that kind of logic. Just quickly before I open it up to questions, I was going to mention some statistics that are out there about the visual impairments and so on. But instead, what I'm going to do is just mention one that was a little bit of a shock to me. According to the Lighthouse National Survey on Vision Loss, as a study that was put out in 1995, unfortunately, I couldn't find a more recent statistic. But it stated 26% of people without a visual impairment report fear when meeting a person with a visual impairment. They feel that somehow they're going to become blind or it's contagious. But it's, you know what's so sad, though, is when you're dealing with foreign cultures, it's not only visual impairments that are affected, but any type of a disability. There are a lot of taboos out there that suggest that if you touch somebody with any, like let's say a deformity of some sort or any other imaginable disability, you're going to catch it by touching them. And these are taboos that are hard to break. So when you travel overseas, be cognizant of those things. One thing that I was in Russia about 2 years ago, and one of the things I observed is how healthy everybody is over there. I do not remember seeing a single person with a disability. Well, you're right. I was talking to one of my Russian friends and told me yes, because they're all prisoners at home. And it's true. I ended up staying at this one apartment, and I noticed it was 5 stories. And I asked luckily I was on the first floor. And I asked, so where's the elevator? There was none. And that's the rule in most cities out there. Unless it's a brand new building. You go shopping at a department store, you have to take stairs, no elevators. So these are the kind of, and fortunately you can walk up and down stairs, but there are people that will use wheelchairs that can't. And so just be cognizant of all these things. Now at this point, now that I've talked you to death, let me open it to some, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We'll open it to questions. I just want to make one comment, and then tell you something about my experience yesterday going to LAX. The first thing is, you know, the cultural biases and beliefs about stigma, about different disabilities, yes, they often can be very negative, very limiting. However, sometimes in a rare occasion, they can work in your favor. I was my university did a study tour to Japan 1984, and we were, before going to Japan, we went to Hong Kong, and the tour guide asked me if I wouldn't mind being right up there in front leading the group. And I thought, okay, sure. Well, the reason I later found out was there is a great superstition about being touched by a blind person there, that you're going to get it. So by me, if you've ever been to Hong Kong, you always feel like a salmon going upstream. And just millions of people, it just seems to be on the sidewalk. Well, with me in the lead, with my cane sticking out, I parted the sea. The whole group was able to go through. Everyone was just finding ways of just getting clear of me and the group. The thing is, yesterday, I found that I got a sky cap. Another gentleman and I both got this one sky cap who can't control it, had a difficult time understanding English, and we had a difficult time communicating at times, but made every effort to help us. When we got our luggage and got down to the kiosk there is for the hotel, it was a touch screen, and there was no way to get any help or understanding how to get hold of L.A. Crown Plaza. We had to step outside so I could use my cell phone to call the hotel to let them know we were here. So there's some access problems there, that kiosk. And two was the SkyCap was very willing, took us to the hotel platform is, Island, and stayed with us. We didn't ask, but really were appreciative. But they repeatedly again called from their I assume, dispatcher saying, you know, come back, and like that. And they said, I'm staying here, waiting there. And I'll be honest with you, if it hadn't been for that person staying there, I don't think we would have gotten our shuttle for a while. It was just impossible to figure out with all the noise, which vehicle it was. I guess if there's any way, I understand each of the SkyCaps groups seem to be hired by the individual airlines.
Yes.
I was with Southwest, and that's probably going to be carrying most of us, but we got out for the SkyCap was that there's, I guess, another group of going on locally with the blind that came in. They were just feeling overwhelmed, and yet this was like early afternoon. If there's any way to get the word out to them that there are people coming in, particularly Sunday, will be departing, so that they're at least prepared, because it seemed like a real shock for the SkyCaps, like, where are all these blind people coming from? So that, and let me tell you, everyone, Sacramento just opened up a new terminal. They promoted as the architects is the greatest thing. It is a nightmare for somebody with a visual impairment, low vision. There's hardly any signage because they don't feel it's necessary, and it's black on silver on gray walls.
I'm going to have fun.
Okay. Bernice.
Did we get the water?
Yes,
yeah. We Gene and I couldn't do this show without
spilling the water.
At least it wasn't on his braille this time, was it? First, two things. One is that when you want to ask a question, please stand. And Donna is running the mic. And if you stand, she'll be able to recognize you. And secondly, I wanted to point out my horror story from the airport yesterday. I have a loner walker here, and it's a new experience for me. It's the first time I've flown with it, and they chewed it all to pieces.
Was the walker inside? Oh, would you know if it was inside the aircraft or not?
What they did is they checked it in San Jose, and they told me they were putting it in a plastic bag. When we arrived, there was no plastic bag, and as you can see, it's all chewed it up.
And this was on Southwest?
Yes, Wednesday.
Let them know.
Well, I did. Now I have to go through this. They wanted to take it away from me and give me another loaner. I borrowed this from an independent living center. They wanted to give me an airport loaner for the weekend. I told them no. They said... they didn't know if they could get it fixed by the time I'm returning. And now I have to go through the hassle of getting rides to go get it fixed in San Jose.
I would charge them. Or what I would do is have them take it and send it back to you.
They gave me paperwork to take it.
The baggage office.
Baggage office,
right.
Down there. And they have a vendor that they say will repair it. But... Not, you know, because I don't own it. I don't know if it's going to come out like it was.
Well, they're responsible.
It's the airline.
Mm-hmm.
Gene, up until I mercifully retired 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, Larry Roland and I worked very closely together.
Definitely.
And I was interested in Gene's comments about the meet and assist, because one of the last things that I was involved with were some negotiations with one of the major companies that provides meet and assist services and the airlines. And ultimately, I was blackballed from the meetings because I had the audacity to suggest that perhaps they might want to institute some basic English language skill training or provide them with some testing. Because, in fact, under labor law, if you have to interact with the public, the ability to speak English is a BFOQ, a bona fide occupational qualification. So I was interested in Gene's comments because as often as I come through LAX, which, sorry, Larry, is just too damn often these days, my experiences have been increasingly positive.
Oh, good. I know.
Yeah, I think that they seem to be doing a better job, or at least the folks that I've encountered have been pretty good at understanding needs. I've had wheelchairs show up with the assist person, and I usually only have to tell them once that I don't need a wheelchair, and it works out pretty well. My other question to you, and you touched on it, Phoenix Sky Harbor, and I think BWI in Baltimore, they have instituted service animal relief areas inside security. I just responded to an international airline association with some comments regarding the need for inside security relief areas. When's the first one going to be happening at LAX? In which terminal?
When are you going to retire next? No. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Let me answer that. First of all, I believe within the next year, you're going to see airports around the country with relief stations inside. There's a new notice of a proposed rulemaking that just came out about 2 weeks ago. In it, there are three very important things. Number one, kiosk. It requires that at an airport, kiosks shall be accessible to people with visual impairments, which are the very points I was mentioning earlier, where you'll be able to connect to it, listen to it, be able to touch and feel, and whatever else you need to do to use it independently. The second item deals with the web. No longer will you have to deal with the harassment of trying to get your money back because you've been ripped off by the airline simply because you had to use their phone number instead of using the web to buy your ticket. They're going to have to be accessible to people that use standard readers. And three, animal relief stations, they're talking about putting them inside the terminal past security, which makes – this is what I've been fighting for at LAX for quite some – well, when the rule first came out. I talked to the Department of Transportation about that about 2-3 years ago, and I was told that their intent was to have it inside the terminal past security. The problem is that they made an assumption that it would be done that way. But that's not what the regulation read, and no one was, and as you well know, we don't assume because the airlines, I mean, the airports don't like them inside terminals for whatever reason. But this is changing the dynamic where they're going to have to be inside at each terminal. At LAX currently, we have 5 relief stations, and they're around the circumference of the terminal area. But I'm looking forward to putting them indoors past security because there's no reason why an individual should be in a rush with the threat of losing their – I mean, missing their connecting flight because they had to go use a relief station for their dog. Also, one other thing along the same line of what we're doing real quickly. I've been working very closely with the junior blind. And one of the suggestions they had, and it's something that we've pursued now and are in the process of completing, is putting tackle devices on all of our curb ramps. Curb ramps are being redesigned. In other words, they're going to be right now. Not everyone is compliant, and we're grandfathered in by since it's in the airport. So what they're going to do is tear down what they have for the curb ramps and try to make them as compliant as they can. And they're all going to have tackle devices on them.
You're talking about detectable warnings?
The tackle devices that are on the ground.
Yeah.
With the little warnings.
Domes.
Okay, right, exactly. Truncated domes, yes.
Yellow in color?
Yes, yeah. Right, yeah, federal yellow.
Yeah. Good.
Oh, thanks.
Sound difference?
Sound?
I have a sound difference.
When you start sound on cane contact?
Yeah. Yes, they, that's the way they do them in the city.
So like armor tile? And ADA solutions. That sounds wonderful, Larry.
Great, thank
That's
you.
That's really great.
Well, I think thanks should go to the Junior Blind because they really brought it to our attention. And once we realized that we did have an issue, we had to address it, and we felt that it was necessary because there are enough people who need that. Okay, next, please.
Hi, I want to say my travel at LAX, I've only done it a couple of times, but it's been fine.
Oh, good.
No problems. I've often had a problem where they bring, you need a guide, but they bring wheelchairs and are very resistant to you not going in the wheelchairs.
It's interesting you bring that point up. I've had this, somebody contacted me a while back with a similar problem at, where was it? Somewhere, I think it was in Texas. They insisted that she use a wheelchair, and she's an independent person. And all she needed was simply some guidance, and she didn't want a wheelchair. And she was complaining about that. I think it's a matter of education. Do you know what terminal it is? Oh, okay. Okay. That's good to know, but unfortunately, I can't do anything about other airports. But I will, you know, next time I go to one of these conferences where they have people from Department of Transportation, I will mention it to them. Maybe they'll put something in the regulations.
That would be really helpful.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
I came across somebody who had a really good solution.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If you want to speak, stand, and we'll get to you.
Okay.
There are several people who are out
the door. Hello. I've actually flown out of LAX several times, and when I've asked for assistance without a wheelchair, I've always received it. So it's been positive in that respect at LAX.
Glad to hear that. Thank you.
And that was with United and Hawaiian Airlines and Southwest primarily.
Great. It's good to know the airline or the terminal because that helps us identify where we might have issues that we have to work on. Mm-hmm. Because when people report problems to me, I immediately contact the airlines and expect resolution. We work with the airlines and their wheelchair providers, and I'm on them until the issues are resolved. And we have periodic meetings with them to share common problems that they're encountering, and we work together as a community to resolve them. Thanks to our Department on Disability, when Mitch was on board, that we have a Citizens Committee on Disabilities. And as a matter of fact, I see Abby over there. Hi, Abby. And Abby was on one of the committee members. And what that group does is they give us advice on the issues that they're hearing from their groups and the disability community that they serve so that we can work at resolving problems that may exist.
The and I've also had positive experience when I've said I'd like, you know, once we go through security, I'd like to use the restroom, I'd like to purchase something to eat, and then go to the gate. So they've been responsive in those
great
different requests as well. My question actually has to do with your comment that individuals who use wheelchair assistance are to be checked on every 30 minutes. I'm wondering, does that apply for individuals that receive assistance without wheelchairs as well?
Okay, the way I understand the regulation, I'm not a lawyer, by the way, but as I understand the regulation, if you need assistance normally to get around, then it would apply. But you have to let them know that you need assistance. Otherwise, they'll assume that you probably don't. If you can get up on your own and do whatever other people do, to go get food, use the restroom, or walk around, then that shouldn't apply. But it's only if you require, like if you're in a wheelchair and they leave you in one, or if you have a disability that you don't feel comfortable moving on your own, then they have to check on you every 30 minutes.
I'm Abby Vincent. I recently took a trip last summer. A couple of things I noted. I'm a part-time wheelchair and walker user, and they are now still unchewed. Thank you, airlines. I also found that they were very helpful going through security. I was really sweating it about that, but they did let me hold both hands of the TSA person and walk through the new, what do they call it, scanner.
Oh, right.
And then they brought me my wheelchair right away. The other thing I noticed is that when you check your baggage, it used to be that when somebody standing behind the counter with a computer, it would say, you know, I'm going to New York, and yeah, I packed my own bags, etc. Now they have touchscreen computers there, and you do it yourself. I don't see why they couldn't. I mean, the problem with kiosks is different. I mean, Steve Jobs got all of his stuff accessible to, for blind people. You know, you do the little taps and swishes and all that, and it'll read stuff to you. I think it's possible that they could do that with these computers. So, I mean, actually, after the LAX, we decided not to check our baggage when we discovered how easy it was to... when you get to the gate, then they take your wheelchair and walker.
Right.
And then put it in what they call the belly. I'm not sure exactly what that is. But anyway, they have it there almost as soon as you get off the plane. And yes, they did offer a lot of assistance to me during both flights.
We have probably just time for two more questions.
Okay. I can hear in the back and then...
Quick.
Let me go ahead and give it to Ken.
Thank you. Larry, first of all, hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I think it's all great what's going on. However, there are still some issues, not with so much with the airlines, and I don't know what can be done about this, but guide dogs and the TSA people are still having some issues. I had a couple of friends that took off about 2 months ago from LAX, and over there the TSA told them they had to take the harness, the leash, and the choke chain off the dog. And they were not going to let them through, and the person had to comply with their wishes only because they would have missed their flight had they not done that.
This is at LAX?
Yes.
I will follow up on that.
It was Southwest.
Okay, thank you. I will follow up.
And, of course, TSA, it's almost impossible to get them to do anything they don't want to do. One last question, and we have to wrap it up.
The lady right here in front? Oh, okay. Do you want to make it?
Let me come on up.
Okay. And I wanted to say one real quick thing.
Yes.
I'll make it real quick. For people who are having problems with assistance, insisting on using a wheelchair, put your stuff in the wheelchair and then take their arm.
Okay, Larry's going to make a closing comment.
Right. For those of you that travel, if you have a medical condition that, for example, you have some type of... colostomy bag or other type of a device that you need, make certain you let the TSA people know. Now, there are two ways of doing it. One of them is you can let them know verbally. Another way that they have now are these little cards that you write down your medical condition on there, and you hand that to the person so they'll know, and they know how to work with you. Because, believe it or not, we had an incident about a month ago at LAX where an individual was patted down, but gently. It was not like a forceful type of thing like we've heard about some of these incidents. But it was the catheter on the bag was kind of loose, so it came apart. Fortunately, the person was able to go to the medical clinic, which is at the end of the airport, and they had a device that were able to put in there to close it off correctly. The problem was that it didn't resolve the issue that he had been, you know, his clothing had been soiled. So if any of you want any of those cards, I do have them, and I can give them to you. And I did bring some literature, but unfortunately I could not get it into Braille in enough time. I've tried to make it in large print, but I don't know if that would be beneficial for you. I'll leave a few copies if anybody wants them. I'll put them at the end of this table.
We'd like copies here, and your business card, too.
Okay, real good. Okay, real good. Thank you so very much once again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Well, thank you.
Very appreciate it. And that's it for this workshop. And please show up at 1:30 in this area and for the first general session. Thank you.
Here's my card. Thank you. You know, I might have given up my last one. This isn't mine. You know, unfortunately, I need to get more cards. They're being printed, and I think I gave out the. Yeah, I don't have any more.
What about your literature?
I'm waiting for them. I'm waiting for them to be printed. But I can be reached. I'll give you. Yes.
Yeah, Bernice and I also need it.
I have publications here, and I'll put them out here. But also, this I'm going to give you this book here. Then this one here is, guess you all have to get a hold of me in my office. Sure. Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Here's some copies for you. There you go. Uh-huh.
Do you have one of those little cards? Because I work with the Sacramento
Sure,
Airport.
Yeah, no problem. Right there. And I'll leave some things here at the end of the bar copies where you can take whatever you want.
Is the large print the same as that
book? The what?
Is the large print
the book that has about, I think it's a 16, no, actually it's not quite that large. It's a little smaller than that. But these other publications are about 20 year or 18 font.
Did we have those?
Yes. Let me give you, here's two copies. Yes. Okay, here we go.
Can you
yes. Mm-hmm. Sure. Here's one copy. Here's two copies. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Go. Yes, I'm going to get those right now.
Roger.
There you go, man. You're welcome. These are the medical cards here. Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's. I'll just leave these things here at the end of the counter for anybody that may want them in their possession.
Well, thank you for giving your warning.
No, thank you. I really appreciate you having me. I enjoy doing these things because I think the word has to get out that people have rights and that. We're here for them, and I'm their advocate at the airport. So I'm really glad that you're kind enough to invite me. And I look forward to doing it again if you want.
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to be here in a year's time.
Perfect. So. I'll look forward to it. Yeah. Thank you so very much. Take care. About going through screening.
Yeah.
And if you encounter problems, notify the airport. And notify the TSA people at that airport or notify
take
the.
Take a couple more days.
Yes, help yourself.
Because I
work with. Take a batch. Yeah, here's some more.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything to help them out.
Yeah, I have a.
And if you need more, let me know. We print those at the airport.
Yeah. I'm actually a personal therapist.
Oh. And if you need. Is there any more of this material that you know?
I'll let them know.
Any more? You want some more of these?
Sure.
Here, I have. Let me see what I have. These will